I was brought up a Christian. It's just like part of me. And I guess you make yourself vulnerable when you tell the truth about yourself. But I did. And it was life-changing, actually.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Well, congratulations on being the Children's Laureate. It almost seems overdue because you just seem so perfect for the role from an outsider perspective.
It's just very kind of me.
But you are the 13th, I think, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So have you discussed the role with your predecessors? I mean, you must meet up at various
points. Joe Coelho, who's the one who's retiring, very kindly took me out to lunch and filled me in. His one piece of advice was book your holidays. You know, set them in stone. Because otherwise you won't. I think that was the kind of advice that is, this is the rock I perished on. I don't think it's advice that he followed.
So how much commitment is it going to be then? Do you know?
That's up to the laureate, but I've got a really clear idea of what I want from it. So Joe had cycled around the entire country joining libraries on a bamboo bike that he'd made by himself. So it was quite a commitment. I think Julia Donaldson also sort of went on a tour of hundreds of libraries, but she likes doing that. I'm seeing it much more as a lobbying role. So because I think, you know, we've got to do something. It can't just be a protest, actually, and it can't just be a celebration either. I think we need a policy change. So I'm just going to give it my best shot. So they will be sort of public facing, libraries facing, children, but I'm facing power.
And how did the role come about then? Are you invited in? Did somebody approach you? Do you get a letter? How does it work?
You asked if you would say yes, if you were asked. And then I was asked if I would say yes. And I said, yeah, sure. And then completely forgot about it. Then I was opening a library, which is like not something that happens anymore, in Warrington. So it was full of librarians. My phone went. And the number was Emily Drabble, who I work with on my podcast. But she's also part of the Book Trust thing. So I answered it thinking it was a podcast issue. And she went, well, I've got some great news for you. And I went, well, you know, and she went, you're going to be the next Children's Laureate. And I went, goodness me. I was just really kind of taken aback. But it's supposed to be top secret until the reveal. And it could not have come in a worse place and time. I was like, it was like dozens of librarians staring at me like meerkats. Like, who are like literally the worst people to know? and I was like, and they put the phone down and they were kind of like, yeah, it's great that the plumber's coming. So, and they had to run outside and tell people at home. But so that's how it happened. So that was last November. So I've had to keep it secret since November. And I did. I kept it secret right up to the day.
And were you asked at that point to sort of set out your stall as to what you wanted to do? Or was it a case of moving on?
Yeah, there was kind of like quite a lot of media training beforehand, and like what would you do? What are you doing with the role? And it's been a kind of a cumulative thing for me that I think children did very badly out of the two big crises that we've had. I think austerity hit children really hard, right? And it hit children hardest. And I think in a lot of ways the pandemic did as well. And I think both those crises really accelerated inequality. And I didn't really hear anybody talking about it. So that's been a kind of growing thing within me. That's what I said. I think it needs to be about power. I think we've had 12, 13 laureates talking about how lovely Reading is. I think it's time that someone said, okay, then, what should we do about it? You know?
Yeah. Okay. So it's going to be quite a commitment then. It's going to be quite a task. how is that going to fit in with your working pattern generally? What is your prime task at the moment? Because are you working primarily on children's books? Because you've always done such a lot. Are these other projects going on at the same time as well?
How is this going to impact? I don't know. I mean, I'm writing children's book at the moment because that the others had like a plan that was diaryable. You know, it's like, I'm going to this library, this library, this library, this library. I'm kind of trying to see what I can achieve. So some things have happened and they feel absolutely providential. So in some ways, I feel as though we've really hit the ground running. So like the election, which Book Trust were very worried about, that it would steal all the thunder, but actually the timing of it was great for me, but also it seemed to pick up on, and it was a huge amount of coverage, like completely disproportionate amount of coverage. So I think people were wanting a story there, you know, and then people who I had on my list of people that I would be trying to contact have reached out and contacted me. So that's really great. So things that I, the meetings I thought I'd have to kind of finagle and lobby for, but aiming to have like what we don't know what to call it, symposium, summit meeting. But the plan is that I'm looking for people who do, you know, I'm looking for best practice, and I'm seeing amazing work, you know, and it's not always about money, you know, it's not always about we need a library. It's like, you know, I've seen people doing amazing work with a cardboard box. I've seen people doing amazing work with a very old copy of The Very Hungry Caterpillar that they cut up, you know. So I want to take that, because my focus is very much early years for this, which is not my audience at all, but I think that's where an intervention can make the biggest difference. So I've seen really, really great work, and I've seen places where there's literally nothing happening. So for me, it's about finding a way to share the best work. So the summit, symposium, whatever it is, I hope will be a room full of people with great ideas that they'll share. Like maybe it's like almost like TED Talks or something like that. But that in the room also, there will be people with power, whatever that power is, whether that means that you're the head of an academy trust, a metro mayor, an MP, someone in, you know, the education department in a borough or a council, I don't care. It's like some people with some who can make something happen. And so that, you know, that there'll be an exchange of ideas and hopefully an exchange of power. And I hope out of that, I'll write something that, you know, I'm thinking of in my head as like a manifesto or a white paper that has some solidity to it. It's not just some grumpy old writer going around going, oh, it should be nice. It's like, they're doing this in Sheffield. Post this. Yeah. This in the result. And it, you know, there's no reason that you can't be doing it in Nottingham, you know?
So you're at a position now where you can use your name and your influence and your profile for good. But can we go back to how you started out? I mean, you had a good education. You were at Oxford. You did lots of things there. But how did you get into writing screenplays, screenwriting in the first place? Because that, it must be very difficult. I assume it's a very difficult area to get into. How did it happen?
I mean, the real answer is that I started writing Brookside when I was still a student. Yeah, and it wasn't difficult to get into it because it was just startup. I can tell you exactly what happened. I applied for it. We just had a baby. And I had applied for a job, a kind of secretarial job, and I taught myself to touch type and got my touch typing skills up. Then I went for the interview and they were like, you don't want to do it. That's good. I do, yeah. Okay. Look, you know, you're not going to, if we give you this job, you're going to leave, but we'll give you a shot at doing a script. Yeah, so that was great. And, I, you know, it was very appealing. I looked young for my age. I was very excited about being a new dad, you know. So it's easy to get into, it's hard to stay in, you know, it's very volatile, hard to stay on it. But it was fun, it was very good fun, really good fun, because like, they were just learning as well. It was a completely new way of making drama on television, because it wasn't studio at all, it was shot with these video camera. I mean, it was all new tech then. It's like, it's so old-fashioned then, but they were shot with little video cameras, so It was shot in a very, very different way.
Yeah. So how do you move from one thing to another? Was it a case of pitching each time? Or?
Oh, again, I can remember exactly. Brookside did a co-production with. This is a vanished world. I'm so surprised to be talking about this. They did. There was Thames Television was the original ITV franchise that had an education department, and they commissioned a film, you know, a skills program, but that was shot on film. And nobody, and from the Brooks, they wanted a co-production with Brookside, and nobody else wanted to do it because there was nobody in it. And I just jumped out because it was film. And the editor of that was Michael Winterbottom, and we went on the made like Lids Film School.
Then there was the relationship with Danny Boyle as well, which led to you writing, effectively writing children's books.
Oh, yeah, definitely. So, then, I'd written a script that was a children's film. And it's very hard to get a children's film made in the UK because, I mean, if you're making a thriller or whatever, you know, a social drama, you're up against similar films. But if you're making a children's film, you're up against Pixar and Disney. And, you know, nobody wants to do that. So nobody wants to make it. Eventually, which I think genuinely think was providential, Danny came across it. He just basically, like, it was in, there's a big edit studio in London called Delane Lee. And someone had left a copy in the kitchen, and he started to read it while he was making his tin, and rang up and went, "What's happening with this?" Nothing. And so, I mean, we were shooting it quite quickly after them. And he, when we got the money, when it got greenlit for that, the two of us went out to dinner on Hope Street in Liverpool, and he was talking about books and books and books. He's a big, big reader. He was talking about this book and that book. They're all quite highbrow. And so he'd be talking about, like, the latest book about the situation in Kajikistan, and I go, and you know, Reebok and Mandy, they're really good. He said, "So why have you never written a children's book?" And I said, "Well, I've never had an idea for one." And he went, "Frank, the film you're making is actually quite a good premise for a child." Starts writing it, and it writes it really quickly. Millions, it was called.
Right. Now that. And it is an amazing book and film. But that's got so much of, well, it seems to have so much of you in it. It's got the stories of the saints and the fact that the boys talk to the saints. And I think that you said that it was quite out there. And you were a little bit, well, you weren't sure how this was going to be received. But Some of the sponsors weren't that keen on taking it in the first place. They wanted you to change aspects of it. Is that right?
Yeah, there's a lot of, like, you know, it's like, film is very conventional. You know, there's these sort of formulae, like the three-act structure and the hero journey. So they all thought that Damien, who can see saints, should be cured of his ability to see saints. And I was like, I'm not really seeing why that's a bad thing. It was like, he needs to move on at the end. And I was like, really? Really? Because Willow looks like keys. I asked Anthony Padgett to help me. And if he was literally in the room looking under the couch, that would be a big advantage to me. You know, you realize that you were in a completely different epistemological space from people.
But you decided to go with it. I mean, you were always convinced that you shouldn't back down. How difficult was that at the time? And I mean, it must be easier now because you're clear about where you stand with things. But earlier on, were you being pressured about
it? Yeah, I was saying, look, this is what I believe. I kind of won it by, but you know, Danny was great. You know, we just won it by bit, really. That bit's good, but it ending, so why would you change it? But it was it's a general publicity thing that I was quite hesitant about saying why the film was like this. And now I wouldn't be, you know. Frank Skinner's got a great phrase, and he says, "You need to put your hand up." And I hadn't put my hand up. And then I did put my hand up, thinking, "Ooh, this is it." And actually, as soon as you put your hand up, people love it. People love it.
So two things there then. So you were nervous about it in the first place because you didn't know how people were going to react. What was your anticipation then? How did you think that the response was going to be?
Just thought you would be like, I don't know. I mean, I can't recapture it. It's such a long time ago now. Yeah, I can't recapture. She just felt awkward. She may have, you know, I was brought up a Christian, so I haven't had that conversion experience. I don't have that burning evangelical thing. You know, it's just like part of me. And I guess you make yourself vulnerable when you tell the truth about yourself. But I did. And it was life-changing, actually. People, and it was an eye-opener because people who you know are not Christian like to know somebody who is. You know, if you read the press, this whole kind of like thing, and actually, when you talk to people, they like it that you say, "Well, I'm like kind of for you," or "I'll say a prayer for you," and send off that. I think there's a hunger there that people don't know how to feed.
Yes, yeah.
But it's this about.
So you say you were brought up in a Christian family, and you've always been a Christian. You've always had faith, and you've always gone to church. So what? Were there no times when you wanted to step away? Why? What? Because that
missed the week. One week, my first week in university, I didn't go to maths, and I was like, "God, that is rubbish." So I had one secular Sunday, but this is like being dead.
How was it as a child then? What was it that appealed to you right from the beginning then? Because your family led you into church and faith.
That you were together. I mean, it's social as much as anything. That you saw everybody. It was that lovely walk whenever everybody. You know, people would fall into step and you'd see people. Love the beauty of it. We lived in a very dull house. I think estates ever since about walking through that door. You know, it was normal. You walk through that door and it was like, you're Byzantium, you know, amazing. Love that. But also that sense of presence and that sense. And it's just grown. You know, I think I had childish reasons for being there, but they've matured. You know, I've seen the value of it.
So it was special as a child because of the atmosphere, the sense of community. So what has it meant to you as you've matured then? You said at university you sort of tried to step away from a little bit and then came back to it. So what does it mean to you today?
Well, it means so many things. Like on a completely human level, I think going to church roots you in community. And community is a word that I've seen change a lot in my lifetime. From community being sort of essentially geographical to community being essentially a group of like-minded people online.
So you're saying about the importance of church and faith and attendance today. So how do you fit it into your life and how important is it to you?
Oh, I go to church on Sunday. I always try to go on Friday. I do morning prayers and evening prayers, like formal things. I just think, okay, so there's all kinds of social things about it. I like the fact that you're forced into a real community is when you're having to mix with people that you don't necessarily agree with, don't necessarily like, don't necessarily have that much in common with. That's community. Community is not a group of people online who love a model boat club. You know, that's just people agreeing with each other. So I like that, and I think that's become more important to me as we've got more polarized as a society. That's a kind of social benefit that I see. But also, I had this experience that was, this sounds mad, but there was, I was in the pub with the kids, and there was one of those guys who street preaches, and he was just yelling his head up, and everyone was walking past him. And he was talking about Jesus talking to Pilate. And I remember him so clearly. And obviously being at sea, he was talking to tombs, he had that walk, he was saying, and he had this big accent, and he was going, and Pilate is saying, what's truth? And Pilate wants an intellectual answer. But there is no intellectual answer because the answer standing in front of him, it's a person, it's a person, it's the person. And that's really shook me. It really shook me because I think of myself as an intellectual person. I am an intellectual person. And do you know what I mean? It's something I've thought about a lot. And that really, really stayed with me that it's a personal encounter. And that you're not, that doesn't, to make any relationship work, you've got to spend time on it. So just turning up, and this is true of writing. You know, most days of writing are horrible. They're just horrible. Grim, lonely, tedious. And you finish the day with this sort of crushing sense of failure. But you've got to keep turning up. You know? And so it's the same. I like that thing of just keep turning up. It's really, really, really important to me. You know, it's true of running a marathon. It's true of writing a book. And it's definitely true of your relationship with Christ. And if you're waiting around to have some kind of vision, then it's never going to happen. You know, you've just got to keep reading it. And the morning prayers is like the Psalms. I have a lot of problems with it, like, especially recently, the Psalms, like, quite a lot of the Psalms are incredibly aggressive. You know, there's a lot about chaining kings and crushing enemies. I find that quite difficult, but I still go through it thinking, well, this is in his head. You know, this is what he read. You know, when you read these, you are sharing something. I don't know what he thought about them. But this is his playlist, you know? So you should listen. So it's about the thing of, like, trying to find ways to walk in those footsteps and trying to find common ground or trying to find him. That's really important to me. And that's why I keep turning it.
But culturally and socially now, we have less of that opportunity to turn up. It's less in schools. It's less just in society. And what we're saying about appreciating books just from that level, we've got less of an understanding of some of the images, the terminology, because we haven't got the biblical knowledge to draw on. How do you see all that panning out? I mean, we are losing something, a richness from that, just really, you know, as a society, not just more so as individuals, but as a society, we're losing that. So how do you see anything changing there?
I don't know. I mean, I'd love to change it, because the thing is, it's huge, 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 huge jobs. I worked for a while. I tried to do a film, a biblical film, just fell apart. There was like a spate of them. The thing is, a film is a big ask, you know? Like, so, you know, Millions, which, you know, I said, I'll around. That was about 8 years. I just had a film out of Kensky's Kingdom. And that took 20 years, you know? So there comes a point at which you kind of think, well, is this a good use of your creative energy? But I know exactly what you're talking about now. I find it difficult to bring the two together. So I was really pleased that if you go and see Kensky's Kingdom, there's a bit where the boy is washed. It's about a boy who's washed up on a desert island. And there's a bit where it's very biblical. I mean, he's washed up, he's completely alone. It's really hot. There's no water. It is the 40 days. It is the wasteland. It is, you know, the valley of bones, you know. And he just lies on the floor and says, help me. And immediately he says, it help comes. And that help comes in the shape of Kensky, who's this big shaggy Christ figure, you know, and comes in the shape of food. So, and that's sort of very explicit, and it works really well. So it's there in the structure, you know. But it's hard to find a way to express that in a movie. You know, it's very difficult. I always put something in the books, but I know exactly what you mean. We are losing. Even culturally, we're losing those riches. We're like, it's much easier to get a book published about Norse mythology than it is to get a book published about the story of Christ, or, you know, Christian iconography. That's I found that really tedious and depressing.
Which of these topics has not been covered on PremierChristianity.com? UFOs, near-death experiences, Doctor Who, Christ's return, the faith of celebrities, and Andrew Tate. Trick question. We don't shy away from any topic. We cover faith as it affects us in daily life and give you the bigger picture. PremierChristianity.com. Special podcast subscription offer at PremierChristianity.com/podcast.
You know, it's also worth saying, it's quite hard to control a movie. You know, so you can lose things, but in the books, it's always there. And then there's also that thing of, like, just making it normal. Yeah. You know, like saying, so they went to church or I said my prayers or whatever. And I always do that. That's an easy thing to do, to mark the characters as, like, this, like, I made a film with Bill Nye, a quite eccentric film, a couple of years ago, called Sometimes, Always, Never, in which the Bill Nye character, like, says his prayers before he goes to bed. That's like, he's in this very awkward situation where he shared a bedroom with his grandson. And he keeps shutting his gun, so I'll go home and say my prayers. And so that's, I'm really pleased with that. Or I did a film about football called The Homeless, called Beautiful Game, in which there's a nun who's like a key character. The shape of the film, if you're looking at about grace, you know, and she says that. Yeah. She's got this great line that I've seen happening, seeing photos everywhere, where she says, no one saves themselves. We save each other, you know. That's come from two places. One is from St. Teresa of Avila, who says, your hands are the only hands that God has on earth, you know, which is a brilliant thing to say. And it also came from Alison Becker, who was the Liverpool goalkeeper, who lost his father and then was very comforted by the messages from the fans. Nobody interviews a goalkeeper, but he scored a goal. It's completely unusual. So he's suddenly been interviewed everywhere. And every time he mentioned the messages accompanied that, and he said, "This is how God loves us through each other." And I said, "Oh my God, that's amazing, you know." So I feel really chuffed that channel permits from that.
So it is natural for you then to incorporate this in your stories. But what about the trend? It seems in a lot of children's books, there has got to be a message, or there's got to be something that children are learning from it and all that. I mean, how do you feel about that?
So I'm temperamentally incredibly averse to that because I believe in fun and play. So that's, yeah. I mean, you've hit the nail on the head. That for me, that's like the conundrum that I've got. That I want to share the word and I want to share my sense of wonder, and which to me is a Christian response. And I want to share my sense of grace and providence, which is like, I you know, to me, they are major historical forces. But I also don't want to send messages.
Yeah.
But, and that's been true of children's literature from the very beginning. Like, if you look at Alice in Wonderland, like, immediately before Alice in Wonderland, there are lots of poems for children that are supposed to be improving. You know, how doth the busy bee improve its shining hour? And you were supposed to learn these to be a better person. And Alice in Wonderland is like a terrorist assault on all those things. It's like, so that those poems that are in Alice, they're all undoings, unravelings of those poems. None of them is like, oh, is that a rent a poem? So this, how doth the little crocodile improve its shining tail, you know, and the walrus and the carvers, they're just exactly, they're parodies of morality. Yeah. And I'm definitely on the Alice side. Whether that's a temperamental thing or not, I just think it's cheating sending messages. And like, you're completely right, like the whole scene is full of, you know, messages about the environment.
So what about the books that influenced you as a child then? I think you've mentioned numerous ones in different places. But how much do you, tell me about how you look back on those books that influenced you and what they mean to you.
We completely destroy everything I've just said and say. It desperately wanted to believe that Narnia was a real place.
Yeah.
And Narnia is very explicit. You know, it's the story of the atonement. It's completely that. That's different, isn't it? That's different from sending a message. That's telling the truth about the way you say things. And Narnia was full of wonder. You know, Narnia, literary critics sort of attack Narnia because it's so incoherent. You know, there's Father Christmas in it and naiads and dryads and then stuff you've made up. And to me, that's like, well, no, that's not incoherent. That's the way a little boy wanted the world to be. Yeah. And that's the world the little boy found in his head when he was alone in a big house in the mountains of Mon, you know.
But there seems to be a lot of sort of realism in children's writing today, as in we've got to reflect society as it is so children can be helped to understand it. Perhaps I'm generalising. But what about the wonder that you're saying then, of the excitement and the adventure and the traditional stories? You've got the podcast, haven't you, when you're highlighting great writing now. So how do you analyse children's books today? What delights you and what do you think is a bit challenging?
Okay. Well, I think the message sending is challenging. You know, whatever that message is, whether it's like a completely unproblematic message about the environment or anything else, you know, that's more political. I find that difficult. But then some people can pull it up. But to me, it's always like wonder first. You know, wonder first and fun first. I think that's what we shouldn't be molding minds. We should be letting them play. You know, I think that's a huge thing to do. So, and there's amazing stuff going on. You know, there's a lot of great fantasy stuff, really great picture books. I mean, if you listen to that podcast, nearly everyone on that's amazing.
And the reading, then, you didn't give me any of the books that you read as a child. Are there any? Well, apart from Narnia, which the C.S. Lewis, which yes is.
Oh, Narnia definitely, and then Ursula Le Guin's The Wizard of Earthsea, which is also quite allegorical. You know, it's about a young wizard who kind of overreaches himself and then has to repair the damage. So he's the bad guy. I don't like stories with bad guys, but I do like stories where the good guy is also the bad guy. I love that. So absolutely great. And that the definition of magic in Ashley Gwen was something that really spoke to me, because it has two kinds of magic. There's illusion, which is flashy, but there's real magic, which is studying things as they are and learn their real name. They all have a real name, so there's a kind of knowing it. The idea is that you study something till you really understand it, and then you have some tiny bit of power over it, but the real power is in understanding it. I loved that. It made knowledge very sexy, I thought. And I'd great man. Fantastic man. So Wizard of Earthsea. Women books. Huge for me. Earthsea, the Women's Narnia. Magic World.
And they bring a smile to your face when you think about them. And you mentioned a lot about joy and happiness as well. How difficult is that to bring to the fore with children these days? You're saying about the pandemic and all that they've had to face. So how do we counter that? How do we bring happiness?
Well, I think joy and wonder and happiness are the important thing. I think that's the message of Christianity. Yeah. This is good. God saw the world and it was good. That's the start point. And there are a lot of forces telling you it's not good, but it is good. I think that's to me, that's a huge, huge thing to remind people that it's good. And I think that's not unproblematic for a lot of people, and it's not simple. We talked about this, the thing, I had a big epiphanic moment for becoming a children's writer. I've always really loved children's books, and I'm very aware of the debt that those books that we just talked about, I owe to those books. I did And I was interviewing somebody. I was interviewing a woman called Mariana Mayer, who was a Roma gypsy, and she grew up in Switzerland at a time when the Swiss authorities were kind of taking Roma children into care very young, if they could. The idea was you've got a better chance of growing up to be a good Swiss citizen if you're brought up in care than if you're brought up by these wastrel, dreadful, wandering people, And Mariana was saying to care very young. When I met her, she was an advocate for nomadic people. She spoke at the UN. She'd written this amazing book. She was very kind of together. But her CV was horror story. It was she'd been in seventeen different institutions, done a spell in jail, she very narrowly missed a lobotomy. So their own kids stayed into care. And because she was very rambunctious, she kept kicking against it. And I said to her after a long conversation, why were you so rebellious? Why did you know? You were taken very young. It was an all-encompassing thing. How did you know life should be better than this? And then I'm going to go, should I read Heidi?
Goodness.
It's oh, wow, okay. And that, which is very explicitly Christian book, by the way. I mean, that's another thing we should talk about, the great Christian stories that all the Christianity is then streaming out of. where does that happen? Anyway, so the power of Ivy, that's okay, so that's, that felt this was at the top of an Alp, researching a film that never happened, and I didn't even think it was going to happen. That's why I'm here to hear that. That's what I'm doing here. I can't wait to hear that. And that was the best experience. But, because of what she'd read in Heidi was, you deserve a nice place to sleep and people should be nice to you. And that's really empowering.
Yes.
And so that's been my lodestone, that you're worthwhile. It's a good life. It's a good place. It belongs to you. I think that's it. I've got a message just that.
Yeah. But you're saying that we're, as you said about Norse myths, and we're it's almost like there's an embarrassment or there's a a fear or there's a condemnation of anything that's Christian. It's stripped out, as you say. But how much then are you free to be able to talk about your books? I mean, in schools, for example, how do you feel about that environment?
Why would I do that? Why would I not? And I do talk about that in schools. I talk about grace. I talk about providence. I talk about presence.
So we're making these obstacles for ourselves then as Christians, really, because we're...
Well, you know, like, because it does get stripped out. So, like, if you see it, if someone made a film of Hans Christian Andersen, like the Little Mermaid. Little Mermaid's full of Christian imagery. It's all gone, you know? And that's partly because some of it doesn't work. You know, some of it just drops out because it's not great. It's not really fully integrated. Well, it does get written out. I remember giving, this is such a silly example. I remember giving an interview to The Guardian and saying the things that made me were Blue Peter, Nothing, Jack and Ori, punk rock, and church. And they said the headline was the things, and the writer doesn't write the headline. I know that. It was like the things that made me were punk rock and Jack and Ori. So it does get kind of elided out, but you just got to push back, don't you?
Yeah.
I do think people like, I mean, I go back to Frank Skinner saying you've got to put your hand up.
Well, yes. And there was somebody, I read an interview with you somewhere, and it said that you carry your faith with a palpable undefensiveness about it.
Yeah, I'm not defensive.
But you said that's learned, though. That's a privilege. So what do you mean by that?
Well, just the things that we've been talking about, it took me a long time to get to that position. Yeah, I think I was embarrassed. You do feel as though all the questions about Christianity that you somehow need to answer them, about it's the bad side of its history and all those things. Like, and secular people don't feel that. You know, atheists don't feel the need to be answerable or start. So why is that a question, you know? So, and also, like, I think one thing that's really come home to me the last few years, for all kinds of reasons, some personal, some political, is the importance of knowing how to be happy. And it struck me, like, that there's an environmental aspect about it. I think our consumerism is rooted in it. You know, bound unhappiness, you know, creative unhappiness. Yeah. We're constantly being told that, you know, we could look better. We could, you know, we could have bigger, more luminous lives if we just buy this, buy that, the other. The ability to be happy and to know that you're happy is hugely important. Personally, but on a global scale as well. And the more I look at the Gospels, the more I think, well, they're about, like, I think they're seen as commandments, like a set of rules. And the older you get, the more you realize that this is how to be happy. If you do learn to forget, you will be happy, you know? And it seems to me that's the set, like, that I don't mean like how I've missed it, because the Beatitudes is happy are. You know, it's not, you know, you get a badge, you know, you'll be top of the class. Top marks go to, it doesn't say top marks go to the peacemakers. It says happy, yes. You know, yes. And it's happy. You know, I think it is down to be happy. And I'm always struck by that when they're asked about Jesus, they don't say, oh, he came to do miracles or he came to impress you. They say, oh, he came for the forgiveness of sins. That's all they say. That's literally all they say about it. They didn't say, oh, he came to be king of the world, or he came to, you know, feed back, or he came to walk on woods or anything like that. He came for the pickings. It's like, oh, wow. Yeah, that's what it's about. It's about being there.
So we've been talking about the importance of reading. So how do you approach the Bible then? Is that a daily...
Well, morning prose is like a kind of lectio divina. I'll do a separate thing of trying to read a bit of better the New Testament every day. I don't really see the Gospels separately. So, like, I love the Acts of the Apostles. I love Paul's letters. Frankie and Matt, and as they are, I particularly love the letter of St. James. I get kind of goosebumps about the letter of St. James. Because it's so narky. It's so ill-tempered. I read it, I think it was really close to Jesus. I can somehow, when I read the letter of St. James, I can hear a voice. You know, I think, oh, this is how they spoke to each other. They're actually quite snippy. You know, we have that Jesus lives meek and mild. And from reading St. James, I look at the Gospels and think, we need to see quite often. Don't come.
But how do you read it then? Do you study? Do you have notes that you go alongside? Because what you're saying is you really inhabit the characters, which you would with Lectio Divina. But is that what we're missing as well, generally, as a church community, that we see things too sort of, this is the wrong word, but reverentially, instead of seeing ourselves as these were real people, how were they thinking?
That goes back to that guy in the park. Yeah. It's like, so no, I don't study, I don't make notes. I just keep going back to them, hoping to notice something personal. Yeah. You know, hoping to notice that something human, because in the end, so it's about an encounter with a person. It's not doctrinal. I mean, I love doctrine, I love theology, but that's not where the answer is. The answer is him. Yeah. And you just, that's all you've got. You know, what you've got is letters from someone who is quite close to him, definitely. Letters from someone who was fascinated by him, the Acts of the Apostles and the Gospels. And that's it, really. So I just keep going. And like I said, if I read it, when I read the Old Testament, they were uncomfortable. And I always think, well, he didn't listen to this. What was he thinking when he was... I always have that, like, what did he think when he heard that?
Yeah.
When it's all like, I got to swipe your kings and chain them up and chuck them in the sea, it's like, you like that? I don't know.
But you have written a book about forgiveness. That's what we've talked about before, which is incredibly powerful. We need to talk about one aspect of that again. But is that something that you'll revisit? Is there something that you will share again about? A Christian book, yeah.
Yeah, I would really like to. You know, I would really like to find a space to do that. Yeah, definitely. I really enjoyed writing that. I thought that whole series was great, actually.
But you, in that book, you mentioned the railway man, Lomax, and what you were saying earlier about the Heidi story and being on the Alps, meeting people and learning from them. But in the projects that you're working on, how much is of it is you gaining from each one? Because the books you...
So like the railway man is another frustrating thing, because that took about 15 years to get to the screen. And then, like, between you and I, when it got to the screen, wasn't what it could have been, you know? But the fact that it was delayed meant that I spent a lot of time with Eric Lomax. And that was amazing, right? So that was meant to be. And the Homeless World Cup film took forever to get to the screen. But again, you end up getting quite involved with the Homeless World Cup and hearing lots of amazing stories and seeing people from all over the world. I think we went to the Homeless World Cup itself about 5 or 6 times and really saw amazing people, you know, that was great.
So the films give you quite a bit and obviously feed lots of different areas. So how do you cope when that lack of control with films for a start and also that time? I mean, that is a ridiculous amount of time, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's not like you're doing it every day for 15 years. That goes away. We talk about the annual Christmas rewrites of the Beautiful Game. The annual Christmas rewrite of the Railway Man. But I used to like filmmaking, if you're not in a Hollywood studio, it's seasonal. It's substantially like, it's like farming, you know, like this. The days get shorter after a certain point. If everything's not ready by the end of March. So it just, there's news when it's been like, oh, we're ready. You put your accommodation and you're ready to go. And then it's like, but he's dropped out.
That could be seen as a huge disappointment. There could be rejection. There are lots of negative emotions attached in something like that, particularly when you've invested in a project and you can see what an amazing thing it could be. How do you yourself deal with it? Are you just so philosophical about it now that that's
what I do? Yeah, I'm not emotionally invested. I work really, really hard. I want it to happen. But it's not where my emotions are.
You were saying about the filming of the Homeless World Cup, and I think you said somewhere, don't know where, that you were pleased to be working on it because it was something worthwhile.
Yeah.
So what do you mean by worthwhile then, and how do you decide on projects?
The impact of the film is clear.
Yeah.
You know, so the Homeless World Cup is an amazing project. You know, it's a football competition for homeless people. It's grown year on year. It's like 60 nations involved in it. But for some reason, it's not very well known in quite a lot of European countries. So I thought, like, if you can make a popular mainstream movie about that, that will make it a massive difference. And like the week it came out, Mel, who runs the whole thing, rang me and went, this is like, should I've spent 20 years making phone calls, suddenly I'm answering phone calls. It's like, so that was really great. And it started cheering. And also, but also the story itself was worth telling. You know, it's a very explicitly a story about redemption. It's about someone going back to that earthy thing, someone who's their own worst enemy and can't solve themselves, and someone else solves them. You know, and you can see him screw up. And it was quite one of the reasons that was a difficult film to make is that a huge amount of emphasis on sympathy in filmmaking. You know, we've got to root for that character. And the many characters like not that nice. Yeah. You can see it's hurt and you can see it's damaged, but it doesn't seem very lovable. But someone in the film loves him. And that fixes him. You know, that's that was quite a tough story to tell. You know, quite a tough story to sell.
So what is your decision-making process when you are offered a project then?
Yeah, well, first of all, you know, you're very likely to be living with it for a long time. So it mustn't be something you're embarrassed about. You know, it's got to be something that you can put a lot of you in and that you believe it's worth the effort. Yeah. So I don't kind of do just sort of knock stuff out. But that's not a moral thing. It's just that, like, I know because I'm not going to go to Hollywood and I'm not a mover and shaker that it's going to take a long time, you know?
But you've got the control, you've got more control of what you want to present in your books. But presumably the impact or the potential impact is less than with the film.
Yeah, that's hugely less.
So how do you, what is your hope for your work? What is your aim for your work with each project that you take? How much impact do you want to have?
That's such a tough question. I mean, the honest answer is I'd like to write that book that it's like, oh, wow, everyone's got to read this book. Yeah. And it will be like a moving thing that you kind of, you're out trying to catch that big marlin fish. So that's the honest thing. Yeah. I'd like to have a huge impact. I'd like it to be a book.
But you are likely to have a huge impact as a children's laureate.
But a specific impact, like I'm looking for a systemic change. That'd be great.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you. It's been very, very lovely conversation. I really enjoyed it.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.